This is a very serious podcast.
So we read True Grit
mm-hmm.
by Charles Portis.
Yes.
And we watched both the movie adaptations. I love this novel. It's written in 1968 by Charles Portis. And the film adaptations, there are two of them. One is from 1969. It's directed by Henry Hathaway, and it stars John Wayne as one of the main characters, as Rooster Cogburn. And Kim Darby stars as Maddie Ross.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Campbell as LaBeef. Robert Duvall as Lucky Ned Pepper. And then an actor I haven't heard of named Jeff Corey, who stars as Tom Chaney, but I've seen him before in other things. Like, he's probably one of these Star Trek retreads. Mm-hmm. Maybe another one. And then Dennis Hopper as Moon. And it's really good. That John Wayne won his only Oscar for his role in this movie.
I find it surprising that he only won one Oscar.
Yeah. Yeah. I do, too. So, oh, yeah, Jeff Corey. He's not a household name. But according to my research on him, he's a very busy character actor. He had a lot of credits. I mean, if like I said, you recognize him if you watched a lot of like vintage TV from the 60s and the 70s and the 50s, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then, like I said, there are some Star Trek retreads in this movie, right? Mm-hmm. Who could forget Kim Darby playing Mimi?
Miri,
in the episode called Miri, with the famous line that goes,
"Study, study, study, or bonk, bonk, bad kids."
That's right, that's right. And then another actor in this 1969 version, Alfred Ryder, who played the defense attorney who cross-examines Cogburn. He's in the husband in The Man Trap, that one about the salt-eating creature.
Right. We don't want you here.
Yeah.
That guy?
That guy. And then, okay, and then this is great. One of the most recognizable voices of all time, John Fiedler. He plays J. Noble Daggett, and he plays the guy in Wolf in the Fold, an episode of Star Trek, mm-hmm. the one about the contagion of fear, right. Monster that goes around.
Right.
But John Fiedler is probably most well-known to most people as the voice of Piglet in those original Disney Winnie the Pooh cartoons.
Yeah. And in The Wolf in the Fold, we like to quote him by saying, "You will all die, horribly die."
Yeah, that's right.
See, I know my original series.
So that's the 1969 version. And then they remade it in 2010.
Mm.
And that was directed by they wrote the adapted screenplay, and that's directed by the Coen brothers.
Mm.
And it is outstanding. Really, really good. We see Jeff Bridges as Rooster Cogburn. A brand new actress named Haley Steinfeld as Maddie Ross. Matt Damon plays LaBeef. Barry Pepper plays Lucky Ned Pepper.
Mm-hmm.
And then Josh Brolin as Tom Chaney. Just amazing.
Great.
And then we get Donald Gleason as Moon. I mean, it's just an amazing cast.
Yeah.
And this movie got 10 Oscar nominations, but didn't win any because it was up against some big time movies that were winning Oscars, like The King's Speech and the
Fighter as well.
Yeah, so it was. It's not that it didn't stand a chance, but it was up against really tough competition. Mm. But it's just an outstanding, outstanding movie. But what is this book about?
Welcome to Splanknicks, the Society for the Preservation of Literature, the Arts, Numinosity, Culture, Humor. Nerdiness, inspiration, creativity, and storytelling.
Right, well, it takes place in the late, like, 1870s, 1880. So a Yell County, Arkansas homesteader named Frank Ross goes to Fort Smith to buy some ponies. A hired hand named Tom Chaney accompanies him, and Chaney, who is drunk and losing at cards, shoots Ross dead. So Maddie Ross is Frank Ross's 14-year-old daughter, and she travels to Fort Smith to settle her father's affairs. And while she's there, she decides to avenge her father's death, to go after Tom Chaney and make him pay, basically.
Mm-hmm.
She hires a U.S. Marshal, Reuben Rooster Cogburn, to go into the Indian Territory and capture Chaney and bring him back to Fort Smith to be tried and hanged. So that's the premise,
mm-hmm.
basically.
So, yeah, and so we should note, there are definitely, this podcast is going to be filled with spoilers, because we're going to talk about everything. So if you've never read or seen True Grit, and you don't want the story spoiled, do pause here, go read the book or watch one of the movies, and then come back to us. We'll wait. Okay.
Welcome back.
Hope you enjoyed that. And now we're going to talk about this book. Yeah. And the movie and the artistic licenses, for example, that take place. Studying a movie adaptation alongside the book is really interesting sometimes, because you can see what they do to change things around a little bit. What did you think of the different fates of Labeef in the different versions?
Well, while I think that it's more realistic that Labeef would be killed by such a severe blow to the head. It was a pretty big rock. Mm-hmm. I do enjoy that he survives in the book and the 2010 movie. He survives in the 1969 movie. He dies, and in the movie, and I think maybe also in the book, Rooster has this really funny line when, like, he goes to rescue Maddie from where she's from the pit she's fallen into, and she says, "How is Labeef?" And he says, "Even a blow to the head could silence him for only a few short minutes."
Yes, it's one of the best lines in the movie, and it's so well set up because of the way they play those two off against each other, where Labeef is just like pontificating on all the time.
Yeah, there was something where he was like he's talking about all of these like legal terms or whatever when they're in the lodge.
Yeah.
After he's been like shot and dragged behind horses and trampled and nearly bit his own tongue off and stuff.
Right.
And Rooster is like, yes, you know, it's astonishing to me that this guy he can be shot, trampled, nearly bite his own tongue off, and still spews the banks of English or whatever.
Yeah. Not only does he not cease to talk, but he spills the banks of English.
Right. Yeah.
Just amazing. Yeah. Yeah. So good.
Yeah.
But I agree. It was no one would have survived that blow to the head. You know, he should have. But, you know, in movies, we often see things where there are fights or there are things that happen where anyone who has any sort of medical knowledge or trauma medicine knowledge would look at that and say, well, that guy's dead.
Yeah.
No way.
Like in Die Hard, John McClane would have died like 20 times.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. For sure. For sure. Yeah. There's some great, great sort of video compilations of all the things that should have killed John McClane.
Yep.
So I think we've even talked about that before. Now, Maddie's character is interesting, too, because they design her a little differently in the 1969 movie versus the 2010 movie. And it's a pretty subtle difference, but worth noting. I think the 2010 movie is a little more true to the book. But I think the reason they made this choice in the 1969 movie is because you want to establish sympathy with your main character. And so they did that in the 1969 movie. It begins with at the Yell County homestead with this, you know, nice warm interaction between father and daughter, and that is entirely absent from the 2010 movie. The 2010 movie begins with a shot of Frank Ross's dead body lying in the streets in front of the place where he was shot, and then Chaney just galloping away. And so each approach was different. So in the novel, right away, the reader is just swept away by Maddie's voice. She's just so distinctive. And the sort of unintentional humor of this officious little teenager turned spinster, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's unintentional to Maddie, but not to Charles Portis, who...
Yeah.
He deserves all the praise for creating this amazing character, you know. And then in the 1969 movie, they've got this scene at the beginning where there's this little sweet and tender scene, and we come to like Frank Ross. And we are shocked when he's murdered in cold blood by the scoundrel Tom Chaney. And we're definitely on Maddie's side when she wants to see Chaney brought to justice, for sure. Hmm. And the way Kim Darby portrays Maddie is with a little more naivete, a little more vulnerability, a little more innocence. Those are definitely emphasized in order to get the audience, you know, on her side. You know, it's this 14-year-old girl whose father's just been killed. Okay. In the 2010 movie, they go after the audience sympathy for Maddie in a little bit different way, right? She's precocious. She's humorless. She's heartless, but she is hysterically funny. We love her because she makes us laugh.
Yeah, that whole scene where she's haggling with the merchant over all the horses and the saddle and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. We admire
yeah.
her competence, her confidence, which basically has no basis in fact, really, and she has no right to be this confident.
Yeah.
And there's this but there is some subtle like the moment where Maddie receives her father's personal effects. They do it differently in each movie, but it's still effective. In the 1969 movie, Kim Darby literally weeps as she has her father's personal effects in her hands. Haley Steinfeld does it a little differently. She's stoic, face of stone, flint, right? But you can see there are tears welling up in her eyes as she's sort of thinking about this.
It's so far in the story, you've seen her just sort of as this basically just a very efficient, like a very efficient negotiator, just like a business person.
You know? She saw three guys get hanged and didn't bat an eyelash.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. So they design the characters a little differently. I think each one is quite effective. So the movie deals differently with Maddie's arm.
Oh yeah. Yeah. At the end of the story and the climax of the film, right? Yeah. Maddie falls into a pit where there are rattlesnakes and gets bitten by one of them. Yeah. In the 1969 movie, she keeps her arm and recovers from that through swift medical intervention. But in the book and in the 2010 movie, the arm is amputated. And we both agreed that story-wise, it's better that our protagonist lost her arm. So why?
Yeah.
We'll come back to that.
We'll come back to that. Yeah, exactly. There's another change. I don't know if it's deliberate, but the movie and the book are very specific about the time of year that this story takes place. It's in the winter. They go off into Indian territory in the winter.
Yeah. The 2010 Coen Brothers movie it's in the winter, and the book also does it take place in the winter.
Right. But in the 1969 movie, there's no reference to the season. But I think it's important.
Yeah. Well, it looks like it's quite a bit warmer out, and there are leaves on the trees and things in the 1969.
Yeah. 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 So, okay. So what do you think at this juncture? Which do you prefer? The novel, the 69 movie, or the 2010 movie?
I love the 2010 movie. I'm going to say that right now. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think maybe one of the reasons why I like it better is because it's truer to the book. Of course, I did see the movie before I read the book. And when I was reading the book, I was like, wow, they were really true to the book when they made the movie.
I'm right there with you. I think there's much to admire about the John Wayne, Kim Darby, Glenn Beck Campbell version of the story. I mean, John Wayne is really good as Rooster Cogburn.
One part that I enjoyed quite a bit in the John Wayne one, you know how there was that rooster's backstory, kind of, it was where they were like sitting waiting to ambush Ned Pepper and his gang going to that, what is it called, that lodge?
Yeah,
or whatever,
the sort of dugout hunter's cabin, basically.
Yeah, the hunter's cabin, they're waiting. Rooster sort of tells her his story and like how he used to be married and stuff, and the woman said like, the love of decency does not abide in you and stuff. And I thought that was a very sort of, it made you a little bit more, I guess, sympathetic to Rooster just a little bit. In the movie, he kind of like just sort of drunkenly told all these random stories while they're riding along, which is hysterical. So it served a different purpose in each.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, each movie adaptation, the director / screenwriter chose to emphasize things for different reasons.
Yeah, there was more warmth in John Wayne's, and then also the Jeff Bridges version of those lines was a little bit more, I guess, a little bit more jaded and matter of fact. You know, just kind of like, well, this is what happened, and, oh, well, things happen.
Yeah. Now, do you recall, it seems like John Wayne was a little more some regret and sadness about that then in that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I agree. I mean, he just
and that hurts. he had a son, but never connected with him and yeah. all that. Yeah.
That was sad. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, John Wayne deserves all the accolades for that performance.
Mm-hmm.
Although I have to say, I do. It's too bad he didn't receive any accolades for his performance in Hondo
mm-hmm.
opposite Geraldine Page.
Yeah.
That is a Hondo's great a good movie.
Yeah.
That is such a good movie. And then, I mean, obviously 1969 movie has a Glen Campbell in it. You know, the opening credits is a rolling under a Glen Campbell song.
Yeah.
So, but I sometimes wonder, did they do this movie as a starring vehicle for Wayne and Campbell and maybe missed some opportunities to go a little deeper with these characters?
Maybe.
Just because they figure, oh, okay, here we got John Wayne, we got Glen Campbell. There we go. We don't have to do anything else.
Mm.
I mean, it's not a good effort. I mean, it's obviously it's amazing. It's an amazing mm-hmm. movie, but they could have done more maybe. But so reluctantly, I'll express my preference for the 2010 Coen Brothers movie version. Also,
mm-hmm.
I also think that just about everything in that movie was truer to the book.
Yeah,
including the character of Maddie. Is this a true Western? Oh, yeah. I mean, historically, it's taking place in post-Civil War America, sort of frontier America, 1870s, 1880s. And that is like a classic. That's the classic time period for the classic Western, American Western. And there's a lot of historical realism to this story. Fort Smith, Arkansas is a real place. It's you can look on a map. It's on the far western side of Arkansas, on the border with Oklahoma. It's going into that wilderness when they cross the river. They're not going into Oklahoma. It wasn't a state yet. It was just called the Indian Territory or the Choctaw Nation.
Choctaw Nation, yeah.
Didn't become a state until 1907. So, and within that region, there was the Choctaw Nation and presumably some other tribes. But the Choctaw are famous because they're actually native to Mississippi. And they were one of the tribes that was put onto that forced march to go west when they were ejected from their native territory on the Trail of Tears. So it's very sad, very sad episode in American history. The judge that Maddie wants to bring Tam Chaney back to face, Judge Isaac Parker, real person.
Yeah.
Hanged more people than anybody. He hanged he sentenced 160 people to death during his tenure as U.S. District Judge in Fort Smith.
Uh-huh.
He was known as the Hanging Judge. I mean, he literally, yeah. Yeah.
So that's why Maddie wanted him to be the judge.
Oh, yeah, because she knew that he was going to not hesitate to put this guy to death. And, and you know, and the movie, one of the early scenes in the movie is him hanging three people. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and then they go into the Winding Stair Mountains, which is what we now know as Ouachita National Forest.
Mm.
So it's about what would be maybe an hour's drive southwest of Fort Smith now, but that's quite a long way to go on horseback. And going in the winter in that part of the country, it wouldn't be as brutal and dangerous as it would be to go somewhere in the winter, like say in Minnesota.
Yeah.
They're down in Arkansas and Oklahoma, the winters are comparatively mild.
Yeah.
And then there was another thing in there that was a historical tidbit. Labeith and Cogburn argue about Cogburn's stint with Quantrell's Riders, Captain Quantrell.
Quantrell's Raiders.
Hmm. And that was an actual, they were like a gang of guerrillas.
Mm-hmm.
They were on the Confederate side. They would just go around just wreaking havoc everywhere. They were like guerrilla warfare fighters. Mm-hmm. And initially, Quantrell was granted a field commission, sort of made an unofficial captain of the Confederate Army.
Mm.
But then he went out doing all these atrocities, and they eventually just washed their hands of it, and they're like, nope.
Mm.
And he became an outlaw, and him and all his men, including, among them, Jesse James and Frank James and Cole Younger. Those were all members of the Quantrell gang. And so Portis put Cogburn in that gang. And, of course, Labeef, who's just a buttoned-up, very proper, you know, he's like, he absolutely was appalled at that history of Cogburn. So that's part of their antagonism towards each other is Mr. Cogburn's association with the Quantrill's raiders. And so, and like I said, you know, Cole Younger and Frank James, those were real people.
Yeah.
They were outlaws. But Frank James eventually, I don't think he could handle the outlaw life after a while. He just turned himself in. And he basically went to jail for a long time. And then when he came out, he and Cole Younger went around in the early 1900s forming this this Wild West show that they would do.
Right.
And that's in the at the end of the story.
Yeah, that's the dog barking. That's the Wild West show that Rooster is a part of at the end right. of the at the end of the book.
Right. And it makes sense that he would be associated with that Wild West show because he was formerly associated with Cole Younger and Frank James in the Quantrill's Raiders days. Mm-hmm. So they evidently, you know, made contact with him and then he was part of that. So yeah. so those historical tidbits there are legitimate, you know. Mm. And fairly interesting, give it kind of a good context for for the story. And the history around which Portis was constructing his story. So, but we've got some, this story is so rich with thematic elements that grant sort of depth and meaning to this story. It's not just a story of vengeance and revenge and outlaws and chasing and gunfights. Mm. There's so much more to this story than that. What do you think? What are some of the big themes that you noticed in this story?
Well, it's obsession. You're sort of like single-mindedly, ruthlessly pursuing your goal. Like Maddie wants to capture Tom Chaney, bring him back to Fort Smith for trial for the death of her father. There's like things that like, she's very, very set on having her own way. Like, you can see in the scene where she haggles with the horse merchant, she will not give even an inch about anything. She's like, no, you will give me the saddle as well, and the horses, the horses are mine, and I'm going to sell them back to you. And all this stuff,
yeah.
Because I don't need them anymore, so you're going to buy them.
Yeah. I love the line that the guy says, she demands, what, $250 or something for this horse? And he says, I would not pay $250 for a winged Pegasus.
Yeah.
It's a great line, but he loses that argument.
And LaBeouf wants to take Tom Chaney back to Texas for, like, the murder of some senator and his dog, right, or something? Mm. And Maddie says, no, he's going to Fort Smith to answer for the murder of my father. And LaBeouf is like, it doesn't matter what he's killed for as long as he's hanged, right? And she says, no, he wants going to go back to Fort Smith to answer for the murder of my father. And they're like, yep. You cannot have your way in every particular. She's like, well, I paid you to come and help me capture Tom Chaney, and why did I pay you if not to have my own way? Mm-hmm. She's single-mindedly obsessed with capturing Tom Chaney, bring him to justice, mm-hmm. in Fort Smith for her father's murder.
That obsession, it's sort of a tragic hero element of her character, isn't it? Because mm-hmm. it ultimately doesn't necessarily end well for her.
No.
I mean, spoiler alert, another spoiler alert, she gets what she wants-ish. This is all wrapped up in that whole obsession of Maddie's, is this sort of the vengeance, the seeking of vengeance, plus there's honor all mixed in with it. Because, you know, the American South was, and perhaps still is, it's an honor culture, you know, where people took the duty of vengeance into their own hands. And this is, even though it's, that part of the country is definitely in what's called the Bible Belt, and the Bible says, vengeance is mine, says the Lord, I will repay.
Yeah.
People still take people it upon still, themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. To do the vengeance. So.
Yeah. But yeah, so the themes of vengeance, and then this sort of like Captain Ahab-esque obsession of Maddie's to, like, she has one goal, and that's all that it informs every single decision she makes.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. No question of having any kind of pity or anything. Mm. And in fact, she's figuring out which marshal to hire. The one guy says, "Well, he lists all the different marshals," and he says, "And then Rooster Cogburn, he is a pitiless man, double tough."
She immediately asks, "Where can I find him?"
Yeah, exactly. That's what she wants. I wrote down this thing when we watched The Tempest, uh-huh. Prospero's speech where he decides against revenge ultimately. Remember?
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Read that. Okay. Line.
Yes. It's near the end of the play. Though with their high wrongs I'm struck to the quick, yet with my nobler reason against my fury do I take part. The rarer action is in virtue than in vengeance.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, if Maddie had just backed off, you know, maybe so many people wouldn't have died.
Yeah, a lot of people died in the wake of her pursuit for vengeance.
You see it. It's like especially in the 2010 movie, they really bring this home. Maddie gets bitten by the snake, right?
Right.
She gets rescued, and we'll skip to this part. Cogburn's got her on the horse, and they're galloping away to go and get medical care for Maddie. Mm-hmm. And you see them as they're galloping away, this trail of bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is dead.
Yeah, like Ned Pepper and his gang all down in at the base of the cliff. They go past them, and then Moon and Quincy are just sitting out in the elements, unburied, you know.
Yeah, they're dead.
They're dead.
Cogburn's horse is dead. Eventually, mm-hmm. Maddie's horse, Blackie, is going to be dead.
Mm-hmm.
They're all dead. Maybe that's why they decided in the 1969 movie to go ahead and have LaBeouf be dead also.
Maybe.
Because you know, everybody, the old Martin Luther King famously said, the old law of an eye for an eye leaves everybody blind.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the price of Maddie's vengeance.
It's very steep.
Very steep price. We talked about Maddie's arm. Why do you think it's better that Maddie loses her arm? Just thematically and sort of character and story-wise.
Thematically and... Yeah.
It's better that she lose that arm.
Yeah, because it's symbolic of, like, you know, the arm of the law and the arm of justice and like all of that. And it's better for a character with a tragic flaw to suffer some kind of loss. It can be like just the loss of an arm in this case, or the loss of your life, like in a Shakespearean tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
It demonstrates in really brutal fashion the reality of her heart. She's a completely one-sided person. She is all justice and no mercy.
Mm.
And you can't really, like, you need to balance those both to live in a civilized and kindly world, you mm-hmm. know? And so her heart is really cold. And I think that's also another reason why they set this in the winter time. It's this frozen wilderness that they travel across, going after her obsessive quest for vengeance.
Yep.
And of course, the pit of snakes there's so much imagery of snakes as a symbol for hell and the inferno, the depths, you know. So mm-hmm. the fact that she falls into the pit and then she is able to rise out of the pit with the help of somebody else, with the help of Rooster.
Who has two arms.
Yes, who has two arms, but only one eye.
Yeah.
Which I find really interesting. When did he lose the eye?
I don't know. I guess he was in some sort of shot. Maybe, remember he was telling the story about how he put the reins in his teeth and said, "Ew, your hands, you son of a bitch."
Yeah.
And went firing at them. I think he did that once before,
mm-hmm.
and that's when he lost his eye. Why is it significant that the main characters are both disfigured? Is it?
I don't know. I think it might just be kind of like... It's kind of like a pirate movie. There's always someone with a peg leg and always somebody with like a glass eye or a hook. You know, it's just a, you know, like a hazard of the time period or a hazard of the job, you know.
I understand why Maddie loses an arm.
Mm-hmm.
And we understand why it takes place in winter, you know, because her mm-hmm. heart, you know, is as cold as that wilderness.
It's cold as ice. Yeah.
Yeah. Willing to sacrifice. So... And she falls into the pit of hell and comes back out with the help of a savior with both his arms. But his one eye.
Maybe he has learned this lesson already.
Yeah, maybe. And maybe there's something he doesn't quite see, which is why he agrees to throw in with Maddie.
Maybe. I don't know.
He misses... Well, he doesn't miss it. He sees her obsession for being as unhealthy as it is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but why? I mean, this whole thing reminded me of that there's a line from Scripture that goes, it's better to lose an eye and go into heaven than to be thrown with both eyes into Gehenna. It is better to lose a hand and go into heaven maimed than to be thrown with both hands into Gehenna.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that these two characters sort of embody that.
Yeah, that's weird.
That line from Scripture. Mm-hmm. So I can't help but thinking that there's some significant reason why Rooster has got only one eye. And it must be because something about his vision, right from the get-go of the story, is flawed and hampered and impaired.
Yeah.
And we see Maddie's one-sidedness embodied at the end.
Yeah. I think maybe... She's all about the vengeance. And for somebody who's very, like, cold and stoic, her motivation is very emotional. And I think Rooster is more... His motivation is more material and financial. He's like, well, that may have been harsh, you know, but I got the money, you know, and she's paying me well, so here we go, you know.
Yeah, he's very pragmatic too.
Very pragmatic, yeah. Well, and then throughout this story, he comes to care for her, and saves her life. Basically.
Yeah, he's not a pitiless man. No. He may be double tough, but he's not pitiless in the end.
Yeah,
and he's very pragmatic. Like at the end of it, he's like, "Well, we've lost the trail. The trail's long gone. There's no way we're going to find these people. We're going out." And but Maddie still, even with that, is like, she's so mad.
So
that we could ponder a bit. You know, why the one eye. But yeah, maybe it's just like he says, it's just a hazard of the job. But he certainly didn't exactly make the best choices in his life, did he? Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah,
that he did not see clearly enough in his earlier life to make the right choices, and then he ended up in a situation where he had an eye shot out.
Yeah,
you know, because he clearly he threw in with the wrong people in the Civil War, joining up with Captain Quantrell.
Yeah,
he entered into a life of crime. He was an associate of the Jesse James's gang.
Yeah,
he was on the run.
Mm-hmm. He wasn't an ideal family man.
No. So he really, I somehow just sort of lack of vision or lack of just prudence maybe is his making poor choices is what that lack of an eye means. This is great, but we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the language and especially the dialogue that Portis employs and the Coen brothers imitate to great effect in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, they always do this. They find the quirkiest dialogue. I mean, as an actor.
Yeah. The Coen brothers?
Yeah.
As an actor, I would love to be in a Coen brother movie.
I mean, you just want to eat up that dialogue, right? It's just so bizarre and so great, you know? But a lot of it comes directly from Portis, you know?
Mm.
Like there's this... He's like, truly, he's a troubadour of the American South, and he's very justly compared favorably with Mark Twain, you know, for his language. But like, there's this scene early in the book before they go off on their excursion into the wilderness. Maddie says that she was sick the next day. I got up and went to breakfast, but I could not eat much, and my eyes and nose were running, so I went back to bed. I felt very low. Mrs. Floyd wrapped a rag around my neck that was soaked in turpentine and smeared with lard. She dosed me with something called Dr. Underwood's bile activator. You will pass blue water for a day or two, but do not be alarmed, as that is only the medicine working, she said. It will relax you wonderfully. Grandma Turner and I blessed the day we discovered it. The label on the bottle said it did not contain mercury and was commended by physicians and clergymen. Along with the startling color effect, the potion also caused me to be giddy and lightheaded. I suspect now that it made use of some such ingredient as codeine or laudanum. I can remember when half the old ladies in the country were dope heads. So this is you know, these little internal monologues of Maddie's. Well, I mean, people in this book or in Coen Brothers movies do not talk the way people talk in real life. I mean, they just don't. Dialogue is frequently against type. I mean, they seldom use contractions in this story in particular. And One of the Coen brothers' greatest inventions, though, is that dentist.
Yeah, I was reading the book the whole time, wondering when is this random dentist going to show up? And it's just a scene that's not in the book where they're traveling along, and another horse catches up with them. It's this guy wearing this giant bearskin coat. They're expecting it to be LaBeef to be following them. And
this guy appears in the clearing, right?
Yeah, he appears in the clearing.
And Cockburn says, "You are not LaBeef."
He's like, "My name's Forrester." And he's like, "I practice dentistry in the nation for those that, and the medicinal arts for those that will sit still for it." And like, he has like, "Do either of you need medical attention?" With like this kind of wild look in his eye. And I'm like, okay, no.
If but I needed medical
even
attention.
Even if we needed medical attention, we would not be asking you.
That's right.
And he had like a dead body that on the like had, that somebody had given to him. And he's like, "I got it from an Indian who said that he came by it honestly. And I have taken his teeth. I will entertain an offer for the rest of him."
Yep.
It's just this really just ridiculous scene. And it's one of my favorite parts of the movie. It's not even in the book.
It's not in the book at all. I know. It's so great. Cogman has another hilarious line in that scene.
Uh-huh.
Where Forrester says, "I practiced the medicinal arts on those humans who will sit still for it." And Cogman looks at the dead body hanging over the back of his horse and says, "Well, you got your work cut out for you there."
Yeah.
I love that scene, and yeah, it's not in the book.
Huh.
So it's just a great little thing that the Coen brothers invented, which they should be commended for, because it's hilarious.
Yeah.
So.
Just the way that people talk, like, we would be, again, remiss if we didn't do a little tip of the hat to Josh Brolin and his portrayal of Tom Chaney. It's like, he has just, like, this really weird voice. When Maddie goes to get water and she sees him, like, watering the horses on the other side of the river, and he looks over at her, and, like, he recognizes her from when he worked for Frank Ross. He's like, "I know you.
Yeah.
You're Maddie the bookkeeper." And it's like this very strange voice.
Well, even in the behind-the-scenes things in the movie of the 2010, you know, some of the other actors just comment on that. They say that Josh Brolin designed this crazy voice for Tom Chaney, and they're like, "I don't even know how he does that."
Yeah.
You know, just so great,
he's incredible. He's a good actor.
So, yeah, so this is a great Western story, rich, thematically rich, beautiful character studies, an absolutely quintessential Western. I mean, not only does it have, like, the time and the setting and all the, but it's got these conventions of plot, like the greenhorn in the wilderness, right? Maddie Ross, she has no business being out there. She thinks this is going to be like a coon hunt. No. It's the greenhorn in the wilderness who she grows, right? LaBeef later on tells her, "Yeah, you earned your spurs. You became a regular old hand on the trail," you know? And then this, in Westerns, what you always want to look for too is this contrast between civilization and the wilderness. And they're always, and they're often characters who embody those conflicts, you know? And it's really interesting. It's such an interesting genre of storytelling. So and this is a great story in general, even if you're not a fan of Westerns of any kind. It's a great movie. It's a great book. Two great movies. Highly recommended. Don't miss it. Well, thanks for joining us on that conversation.
Yeah.
I hope you found that interesting. And go pick up a copy of True Grit, the book version or either movie version. You'll be really good.
Yeah. All right. There we go. Let's get out of here.
The Splanknicks podcast is produced by Claire T. Walker and Hannah Kubiak. You can contact us by emailing splanknickspodcast@gmail.com. We welcome episode topic suggestions, personal anecdotes, and corrections for those rare occasions when we don't know what we're talking about. Visit splanknicks.com for show notes and transcripts of all our episodes, and follow us on Instagram @splanknicks_podcast. Claire T. Walker is an independent author with two self-published books, The Keys of Death and Startling Figures. Learn more about Claire and her books at ClaireTWalker.com.